among the scholars that will we have Christians and Jewish people after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam? Some scholars believe that no, all of them, when they see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his miracles, and they see Jesus alayhi salam, all of them will become Muslims, will convert to the original Islam.
Very true.
But there is another opinion which says that no, some narrations tell us that at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we have some minorities in the form of Jewish people and Christians. So that is why I say that the majority of the Christians and Jews, they will accept Imam Mahdi alayhi salam as the last savior, and maybe according to some narrations, all of them will accept him.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your beautiful answer and enlightening enlightenment that you made on the questions. And you respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to us in Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah, we'll be with you again with another topic in the field of theology and theological questions and issues in our upcoming session. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا سميحا
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name's Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. And it's here we begin our top story. Violent clashes between UK police and protesters over a proposed law making its way through the country's parliament. Now, if adopted, the so-called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill will change the way protests are held in this country forever. And that has had campaigners and civil liberties groups up in arms as Saipur Reza fills us in.
Bristol, southwest England on the weekend. A peaceful march against government-proposed legislation that gives the police sweeping powers descended into violence. Some clashed with the police, others vented their anger and frustration in other ways. As darkness set in, the situation escalated further. Fireworks were thrown. Police vans set on fire, several officers injured.
I'm opposed to violence of all kinds. That, yes, if there are people who are protesting being violent, I think that they are doing the wrong thing because you don't need to be violent in every situation.
Peaceful protest, very much in support of, not in support of violence. And I'd be very interested to see the discussion about professional agitators, whether that's true. It certainly looked like it on TV.
But that doesn't take away from the seriousness of the government's Police, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Bill. And here is why it matters. Scenes on March 13th of women being manhandled by police officers while attending a peaceful vigil in memory of a young woman murdered allegedly by a police officer.
I think it's fundamentally wrong to stop people's right for protest, right from speaking out, because what other power do we have as a people? You know, that is our biggest power. In you think of history, all the movements have happened, all the powerful change that was created through protest, through crowds, through gathering.
I get the intention, but I think it just gives the police too many powers, and I think their timing is also pretty poor, given you know, how the police are being viewed at the moment. They're losing an awful lot of support.
having seen the way police broke up the vigil for Sarah Everard, whose murder acted as a poignant reminder about increasing male violence against women, campaigners are concerned about more powers for law enforcement, although the government took issue with the police treatment of the peaceful demonstrators.
Mr. Speaker, let me turn to this weekend's events. I have already said that some of the footage circulating online of Clapham Common is upsetting. So whilst the police are rightly operationally independent, I ask the Metropolitan Police for a report into what had happened.
Opposition parties and campaigners say the bill is deeply imbalanced, that it imposes gratuitous curbs on peaceful protests and does too little to protect women, that it introduces longer jail terms for vandalism or defacing statues and memorials than it does for rape.
The UK's Conservative government says the wide range of steps it's taking is necessary to keep people safe. Its new policing bill has already cleared the first parliamentary hurdle, and given the government's large parliamentary majority, it's almost guaranteed to become law, despite some libertarian concerns among its own MPs. Saeed Riza, London.
Well, author and political commentator John Wright joins us from Edinburgh. John, you've written about this very bill. May I ask you to quickly recap your thoughts?
Well, this bill is a panicked reaction by the establishment to the wave of protests that took place last year across England and Wales, starting with the toppling of the Statue of Colston, attacking other monuments, statues of people associated historically with the British slave trade, and most prominently the defacing of Churchill's statue in Parliament Square in London. Because this establishment knows that after statues come tumbling down, often the wall of false consciousness follow. And so this is a rising wave of consciousness regarding Britain's role in the world, past and present, and the Tory establishment is desperate to try and stem this rising tide of resistance and contesting of the official narrative of British history.
Is that how you would categorise what we saw in Bristol over the weekend?
Yes, I do. Karl Marx it was who said, Amina, that necessity without consciousness is blind, and freedom is the consciousness of necessity. And those scenes, as ugly as they were, reflect the ugliness of the legislation involved, which arrogate to the police frightening new powers that would not look out of place in a totalitarian state. And, you know, it wasn't only the protesters who were violent. Some of the scenes and pictures I've seen on social media, some of the footage shows that the police adopted a very heavy-handed approach, just as they did at the vigil to Sarah Everard, who was abducted and brutally murdered, allegedly by a serving police officer. So the optics could not be worse. People were sitting down in front of a police station, quietly and peacefully, and then the police arrived on horseback and in riot gear. So there was provocation, I think. I think the police, in England especially, have never been in a worse state in terms of public confidence, and I think this reflects a rising tide of consciousness as to this mob, the real mob that we are dealing with and people have to be scared of, which is in government.
Now, you say all of this, John, but yet the Conservatives enjoy good polling results. This despite the way in which some have said they've handled a pandemic, this proposed bill. What are we saying now about the opposition, but also about where people's minds are at a time like this?
This government's enjoying strong polling in England, not in Scotland, let's make that clear. It does speak to a very weak opposition. Keir Starmer is an establishment man. He is Tory-lite, in my view. He's done his best to defenestrate Labour of its socialist policies under the Corbyn leadership that preceded him. But I think it speaks most prominently to the establishment or the introduction of US-style culture wars into the UK's political spectrum, into its narrative, over race, over ethnicity, over religion. And Brexit, of course, has unleashed a carnival of reaction. And Boris Johnson enjoys strong support from people who think Brexit is everything and is an end in itself. And, of course, nothing he can do will hamper that support, just as Donald Trump has a strong base despite all his criminal negligence and incompetence and racism and so forth. So the UK has never been more polarised, consensus nowhere, chaos everywhere, and I think it speaks to Britain's international, political and social decline. It's been a long time coming. This is just a tipping point, and I think we're in for a long, hot summer of social unrest in the UK.
A long, hot summer, albeit of social unrest. Thank you so much, John White.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now, Richard Sedan, we saw those scenes. We've heard what Saeed Poureza and John White had to say about their particular views on what took place over the weekend. Your thoughts?
So it's interesting, Amina. And social media is awash with debate and different reactions. And I want to take a look at this first headline, which says, "Police chief condemns the violence and destruction. The 20 officers are injured." Now, the reason we've chosen this headline is because the media establishment, if you like, have largely ran with this narrative, talking about the destruction of police vans and, of course, the injuries to police officers. Now, the reaction is mixed on social media, but a lot of people are basically saying that the government is going to, of course, spin this in their favour to make the argument that the bill must, of course, be pushed through. And actually, what's interesting also is a lot of people, Amina, are frankly sceptical and are asking questions about the minority element of these protests which actually caused the destruction. People are saying, look, we've seen in the past examples where demonstrations have been infiltrated with the sole intention of making the protest turn violent precisely to spin in the government's favour. So you've seen one narrative, if you like, from the mainstream media, but actually many users on social media are very much aware of the potentiality for other narratives, if you like, to have taken place. And certainly that's what's being discussed online at the moment.
All right, let's hear what they had to say in their own words.
Let's go first to David Holt, who comes from the other side, if you like. David Holt says, "We are under attack from leftism. They cannot cope with their constant failures, so they turn to violence." McArdle says, "Presumably there are undercover police who've infiltrated anarchist and extremist groups who can now torch property to kick off a riot and not face prosecution. Just part of the job." And we have a reaction from Moomin, who says, "I've not seen any footage of the Bristol riots. I'm anti-violence and find that stuff depressing. That said, people are angry. Angry with the police bill, angry with the regime corruption, and fuming at police assaulting innocent women last week. It's not right, but perhaps understandable." So this debate is really raging online at the moment, Amina.
Right, and we move across the Atlantic for the second wave of a very disturbing story. The murder a few days back of 8 people in a particular part of Atlanta. And just fill us in on what happened and why it's important, why we've chosen this story.
Absolutely. So our headline talks about the Atlanta Spa shooting, and Robert Arrett Long, who this headline is now talking about, has been kicked out of a Georgia church. So what's interesting is there have been a number of things, really, which people are saying are humanizing this man. This headline talks about the fact he was a church goer. One of the police chiefs actually said that Robert Aaron Long had a bad day. There's other news pieces talking about him being a kind of nerdy, quiet, shy, geeky guy at school. But I think the point here for a lot of people is that, you know, for a long time over the last few weeks, we've seen the narrative that black people have been attacking Asian people in the Asian community. And here is an example of Robert Aaron Long, a conservative guy from a rural part of Georgia, massacring 8 people for which he's been charged. 6 of them are Asian Americans. And many people are saying this is the definition of a hate crime. Other people are saying this is an example of a domestic act of terrorism. And they are saying that the media is reluctant to really diagnose it thusly. And so there's a kind of difference, if you like, between what people are saying is the actual reality and the narrative, again, being pushed by sort of sections of the media. And people are saying, look, let's just call it what it is.
And indeed, if it was anyone else, and what social media calling it, Richard Sedan?
Okay, let's go first to Philip Walker, who says, "You can look no further than the sudden false narrative that black people are targeting Asians. Meanwhile, white supremacist operatives like Robert Arrett Long are massacring Asians en masse. Bishop Talbot Swan says, while America tries to paint a black face on anti-Asian violence, a white supremacist, Robert Arrett Long, murders 8 Asians in Atlanta, and authorities won't call him a terrorist, they're mentioning sex addiction and saying they don't know the motive. And US Political Theater says, did the police also take domestic terrorist Robert Arrett Long to Burger King for lunch, like they did with domestic terrorist neo-Nazi Dylan Roof after he murdered 9 black people in a church?
Well, leave it there, Richard Sedan. Thank you. Now, Palestine has begun administering the first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine it's received from the global COVAX initiative to healthcare workers and older residents in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The United Nations-backed COVAX program delivered some 61,400 vaccines to the Palestinian Authority, with 21,300 jabs also being shipped to the besieged Gaza Strip. The news comes months after the Palestinian Authority blasted the Israeli regime for its decision to block vital vaccines from being delivered to the impoverished West Bank and Gaza Strip. Amnesty International and the World Health Organization have also joined in their calls to Israel, asking Tel Aviv to stop ignoring its international obligations as an occupying power and ensure the fair distribution of vaccines to Palestinians. 5 of Europe's southern states have stepped up calls for help and solidarity to other EU countries in managing the mass influx of refugees from entering the bloc. Interior ministers from Italy, Spain, Malta, Cyprus and Greece met over the weekend to discuss the issue and hash out a new migration pact, which would share the burden of mass migration with other members of the bloc. Thousands of refugees fleeing from Western-backed wars in places like Libya and Syria have died in a perilous maritime journey to reach EU shores. Critics of the EU have previously accused the 27-nation bloc of evading its responsibilities towards people making the journey. More than half of all the UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunise the entire adult population by the end of the summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential 4 freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
Earlier today, ministers from the European Union met in Brussels to discuss the bloc's relations with Turkey and Russia. High on the agenda will be the ongoing dispute over hydrocarbon resources in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea between Turkey, Cyprus, and Greece. Other points of discussion will include the Turkish detention of Kurdish politicians, as well as the imprisonment of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The meeting comes weeks after the 27-nation bloc announced it would be slapping retaliatory sanctions on Moscow over the Navalny case. Following their statement, Russia accused the bloc of interfering in the country's internal affairs. Robert in Lakesh, welcome back to the Bulletin. We're going to kick things off with, dare I say, some more misinformation being directed about Iran from Washington. Take it away.
Well, this time we see the report coming from The Hill. A number of different United States outlets, of course, take the words of U.S. Intelligence officers, as they call them, verbatim, no matter what they're saying. We're seeing this again in the case of this report, where they're saying that Iran had discussed a plan to attack a U.S. Army base in Washington, D.C. They cite two unnamed officials, and it's key that they are unnamed. There was no comment when they tried to reach out to the Pentagon and to intelligence agencies to verify these claims. But many people are pointing out that this comes at a crucial time when the Biden administration is attempting to get itself away from the responsibility which it pledged itself to, that is getting back into the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal. And on top of that as well, it looks like the Biden administration is poised to launch more strikes against the PMU, perhaps in Syria or in Iraq, again, as it did last month after an attack which targeted U.S. forces not linked to Iran. But of course, the U.S. media helped manufacture that dissent when it came to the retaliation, as it was called, which came to a group which was completely irrelevant to the strikes in the country.
So the easiest way now to justify your foreign policy is to just say Iran, whatever.
Absolutely, and we're seeing that reports like this are surfacing all the time when the Biden administration has pressure applied to it to try and get something achieved. And in this case, a promise which the Biden administration pledged, and that was to attempt to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which they have not done. This is a foreign policy layup, as it has been called and described by many analysts. And we're seeing that Joe Biden has completely ignored this.
All right. What's been the online reaction to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here is from Hamid Marandi, who says, "The obedient American media mimics whatever garbage intelligence agencies tell them. They did that before the aggression against Iraq. They did that before bombing and destroying Libya. They did that regularly in Syria to justify aiding Al-Qaeda and illegal military strikes. Never ending," he says. And we've got another one here from journalist Max Blumenthal, who says, "The national security state is fabricating threats to overpower local opposition to further militarization of D.C. First, the bogus threat of QAnon attacks, then this month to justify extending the National Guard occupation of Capitol Hill, and now this."
Okay, we move on to, well, some would say an inevitability in Israeli politics. New elections in just, what, 2 days?
Yes, we will see the elections on this Tuesday coming, and a lot of people, of course, in disarray as things can only get worse from here for Palestinians. It seems that Netanyahu has successfully divided up his opposition, former opposition member Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party. Essentially has been destroyed in the polls. We're seeing that he will not even, or his party will barely make it into the Israeli Knesset this time around. And last time, Netanyahu had 4 opposition parties against him. Now he has 10. So his bid to divide has been successful. And on top of that, he's aligning himself with right-wing racist groups, the likes of which are Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power, as it's known in English, which essentially has been compared to the KKK because of its hardline racist views. Its leader, in fact, was convicted in 2007 of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism. And so when we talk about the Palestinians in this instance, we're seeing that if Netanyahu gets in, he's aligned with these far-right racist parties. And then if his opposition win as well, the number one figure against him is a man named Gideon Saar. Also, things are not looking good for the Palestinians because Gideon Saar is even more hardline than Netanyahu when it comes to the Palestinian issue and calls for the expulsion of Palestinians.
Tweets?
The first we've got here is from an Israeli actually commenting on this. They say 55,000 people last night all yelling go, leave us alone to start rebuilding our lives and our country, a demonstration of power, protest, and a call for change to remove corrupted Netanyahu and his messengers from power, elections in 2 days. So an unhappy Israeli there. Then we have another one here as well commenting on the issue of Netanyahu's being aligned to these racist parties. Says Netanyahu allies with extremist party denounced by many American groups, APAC actually included in that, who are openly calling for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
And this is a man who's facing charges. I don't understand why he's even allowed to run, briefly, Robert.
Well, this victory will mean that he can attempt to get past a bill which would essentially mean that the charges being brought against him would be dropped. So for him, this is a crucial victory to win, and that's why we're seeing him align so he can get those 61 seats in the Knesset and win.
Well, anything to save your skin, some might say. Robert Inlakesh, thank you, and thank you for being with us for this broadcast. Until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the social system and morality of Islam. An important hadith saying of the Prophet is that religion is not what one formally or ritualistically practices, but how one deals with others. This is what religion is. Religion is all about your social and public dealing. It is therefore not sufficient to be pious without performing deeds which demonstrate one's beliefs. Your beliefs and your actions, they have to be in sync. Your actions have to speak for your beliefs. It is a proof of your beliefs. It is reported that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam once entered a mosque and saw at prayer a vulnerable and venerable old man with a long white beard. He was told that the man was in the mosque all day long, worshipping and dispensing the words of Allah to others. The Prophet then asked how he earned his living, and was told that a merchant, not known for his piety, supported him. The Prophet remarked that of the two, the merchant was indeed the more worthy. Brothers and sisters, Islam is a religion that is all-encompassing. Islam doesn't tell you to go worship while your responsibilities that Allah has put on your shoulder are not taken care of. Islam does not ask you to go do those additional worships. And we're, of course, not talking about the wajib here. You know, wajib namaz you have to do, wajib salat you have to do. We're talking about those recommended and long prayers and, you know, worships, acts of worships. If your responsibilities, your socio-political responsibilities are not taken care of, Islam does not encourage this type of worship. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the social system and morality of Islam. When we talk about morality, the first thing that comes to mind are those like ethics, you know, the way we carry ourselves, the way we talk to others, the way we use those pleasant words and, you know, terminologies like welcome, thank you, and all those things, right? But we're talking about the social morality system of Islam, which is very ingrained and interactive with the society. Every Muslim is the recipient, guardian, and executor of Allah's will on earth. His responsibilities are all-encompassing. A Muslim's duty to act in defense of what is right is as much part of his faith as his duty to oppose wrong. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam once said, "If someone among you sees wrong, he must right it by his hand if he can." When it's said by his hand, deed, conduct, action, all of this is by his hand. Now, the tradition continues. If he cannot, then by his tongue, which means he speaks up, verbally oppose it. Then the third level is, if he cannot, then by his gaze, silent expression of disapproval. And the fourth level is that he still cannot do what we just mentioned, then in his heart. The last is the minimum expression of his conviction, faith, and courage. This is what's required to lead such a life where your social system and your moral compass and moral standards, they become in sync. Okay? This is what the ideal system Islam proposes for every Muslim. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
A year ago, Georgia was one of four states that had no hate crime legislation. But a deadly rampage last week that left eight people dead, six of them women of Asian descent, is now providing a test of a law passed last year. and a window into the way that the state's increasingly diverse electorate has altered its political and cultural chemistry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Astrid Herndon and Stephanie Soule. The piece is titled, Why Some Georgia Lawmakers Want Last Week's Shootings Labeled Hate Crimes. Stay with us for more of Astrid Herndon and Stephanie Soule's article. A year ago, Georgia was one of four states that had no hate crime legislation. But the deadly rampage last week that left eight people dead, six of them women of Asian descent, is now providing a test of a law passed last year and a window into the way the state's increasingly diverse electorate has altered its political and cultural chemistry. Georgia, after earlier false starts, passed this legislation following the shooting death of a young black man, Ahmed Arbery, who was stopped, detained, and then shot to death by white residents in a South Georgia suburban neighborhood. Now, last week's shootings, in which Robert Aaron Long, a 21-year-old, has been charged with eight counts of murder, are providing a major stress test for when the legislation can be applied, what it can achieve, and how it plays into the state's increasingly polarized politics. Political leaders, civil rights activists, and national and local elected officials condemned last week's attack as an act of bigoted terror, drawing a connection between the majority Asian victims and a recent surge in hate crimes against Asian and Pacific Islander Americans. Law enforcement officials and some legal figures have shied away from labeling the killings a hate crime, saying there is insufficient evidence of motivation. Prosecutors in two separate counties are still weighing whether to invoke the hate crime laws. But that has not stopped the shootings from resonating as bias crimes for many in Georgia, a state that has been at the forefront of the demographic changes coursing through the South. I don't want to draw any conclusions, but it's obvious to me that if six victims were Asian women, that was a target, said Georgia State Representative Calvin Smear, a longtime Democratic lawmaker who helped shepherd the hate crime bill through the General Assembly. In recent years, Georgia has been a microcosm of the racial divides that have affected the entire country. Last February, the killing of Ahmed Arbery, a 25-year-old, ignited a national outcry, particularly after law enforcement officials initially failed to make any arrests following Ahmed Arbery's death near Brunswick, Georgia. In the aftermath of last week's killings, the response from law enforcement was criticized once again after a spokesman for the sheriff's department in suburban Cherokee County, where one of the attacks took place, downplayed the role of anti-Asian racism in the shooting incident. Political leaders, especially in Atlanta, have gone much further, characterizing the events as domestic terrorism and, at least in part, motivated by a web of racial and misogynistic intolerance. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to Georgia on Friday, casting the shootings in the context of broader abuse and intolerance directed at people of Asian descent. But absent clear evidence of the shooter's intent, there is broad division on whether there are sufficient grounds for adding hate crime charges. Representative Sam Park, a Democratic member of the Georgia House and the state's only Korean-American legislator, said it is impossible to separate the crime from the anti-Asian bias and violence that has surged over the past year. Regardless of the motive of the perpetrator, we very much feel like this is an attack on our community. Condolences are good, words of sympathy are great, but action is necessary. But Byung J. Pak, a Republican, Korean-American, and former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, urged caution before linking the killings to a hate crime before the investigation is completed. Prejudging the case before the completion of the investigation puts pressure on prosecutors to perhaps file charges which may not hold up in court or raise expectations that cannot be satisfied. Mr. Byung J. Pak said, "I would be cautious designating this crime as a hate crime until the investigation is complete. Racist violence has a particular sting in the American South, considering the region's long arc of racial discrimination. Though it is often framed in the familiar context of black-white community relations, a dramatic increase in Asian and Latino populations has also shifted the state's political and cultural composition. The General Assembly approval of the state's current hate crime legislation last year, in the wake of Ahmed Arbery's death, reflected an increasingly purple electorate, as well as pressure from the business community. Three white men have since been charged in connection with Ahmed Arbery's death. Efforts to pass the hate crime legislation were led by Representative Chuck F. Strachan, a former assistant district attorney and Republican who represents an increasingly Democratic district in Gwinnett County. Mr. F. Strachan said he first pushed the bill in 2019, before Mr. Arbery was slain, when it was adopted by the House but failed to gain support in the Senate. Opponents of the bill argued that it stifled free speech. The legislation was finally adopted despite efforts in the Senate to derail it. "Georgia has changed," said Sheikh Rahman, a Democratic member of the state Senate from Gwinnett County outside Atlanta, who is a Bangladeshi-American. Sheikh Rahman describes his district as people from 100 different countries speaking 100 different languages. "What my district looks like, the United States of America is going to look like 20 years from now." Georgia replaced its two Republican senators in combative runoff elections this year, electing Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, and also narrowly supported Joe Biden in 2020. That marked the first time since 1992, when Bill Clinton was elected, that the state voted Democratic in a presidential contest. However, even as Democrats won two Senate seats and flipped Georgia for Mr. Biden, Republicans retained control of the state legislature and the governor's office, leaving them in solid control of state government. The national story about Arbery became very well known, Mr. F. Strachan said in a telephone interview. And there was renewed interest and people raising questions. Why was Georgia one of only four states that didn't have a hate crime law? He added, "We've had arguments that these laws are anti-speech or anti-thought and that all crimes involve hate. We were able to address those." Democratic lawmakers have pointed to the bill's passage as a reflection of politics within the state, not just perceptions from the outside. The Republicans realize that If they didn't do it, they were going to lose this election, said Mr. Rahman. It had to take a tragedy like Ahmed Arbery before it would potentially be applied. But last year's decisions need not determine this year's. Instead, the focus of the Republican-controlled legislature this term has been a very different response to diversity. A raft of bills aimed at making it harder to vote, legislation that will fall disproportionately on minorities. Since last week's killings, lawmakers are discussing whether the hate crime legislation needs to be enhanced and whether it will be applied in this case. In the case of Mr. Long, the use of the hate crime law could be largely symbolic in the event Mr. Long is sentenced to death, which remains a possibility in Georgia. On the other hand, depending on any charges, the law could have concrete effects. A life sentence, enhanced by the hate crime provision, could potentially mean that he would never be granted parole, according to Mr. F. Strachan. Marvin Lim, a Georgia state representative who was also among Asian American lawmakers at the meeting with President Biden and Vice President Harris, called for prosecutors to carefully consider using the hate crime statute. Though officials in Cherokee County claimed that Mr. Long was motivated by sex addiction and not bias against Asians, Mr. Lim pointed out that gender is also protected under the hate crime law. Given the fact that we know, and I understand there are more investigations to be completed, I would certainly urge prosecutors to apply it to the extent legally possible, he said. Mr. Smear, who is black and the longest-serving member of the Georgia General Assembly, agreed that invoking the hate crimes law for last week's carnage was a decision that should be left up to prosecutors, but said the legislation's passage reflected the state's long, slow progress on issues of racial justice. The political pendulum has swung to a great extent, and I think that lots of times external pressure, that tourniquet that's outside the Capitol, sometimes decides what we do in the public policy arena.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to
to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasseri. Stay tuned.
ان الله يحب المتوكل خدا دوست داره در اشخاصی که اعتماد بهش میکنه.
Truly, Allah loves those who have trusted. Here, trustful means the person whose only reference is Allah and believes in Him as the very first and last. In return, Allah loves such people too. In a verse of the Holy Quran, Allah addresses the believers and asks them, "What kind of a believer you are when you don't have your trust in Allah in all of your affairs? You know that Allah is all aware and is informed about all of us. You also know that He is the all-powerful, the all-just."
خدای این چنانی را که من معتقد بهش هستم چرا در مشکلاتم در خانه دیگری را بزنم؟
So why should I knock on someone else's door when I know that Allah has such high qualities? If you ask Allah, He will surely answer you. Since Allah is the all-powerful, He is capable of solving everyone's problems. The only condition is to have trust in Him and be truthful to say that, "O Allah, You are my only hope, and I come to your door solely." Upon hearing this, Allah will help his believer. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasseri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.